Joseph.
The Center Steer Podcast, a Land Rover podcast by Land Rover owners. Welcome to show number 20 of the Center Steer Podcast. It is November 23rd, 2014. I'm John Costage, the host. Joining us today is Harold.
Hello.
Mark on Skype.
Hello.
And our special guests, back by popular demand, Jeff Aronson, the editor of Rovers North magazine.
Good morning, everybody. Good afternoon, actually.
And you're on a remote island off of Maine, is that correct?
I live on Vinyl Haven Island, 15 miles off the coast of Maine. Yep.
Nice. Have you always lived there?
23 years now. But no, I lived in Vermont for 22 years, actually.
Okay. Are you originally from Vermont?
No, originally from Cape Cod, Massachusetts.
Oh, nice. Good. Well, thanks very much for joining us. We certainly appreciate you having us back. And we're making this our holiday episode. And if you have not already gotten your copy of Rovers North magazine, and it is very festive and looks very holiday-ish. So we'll talk about that a little later. But it's a nice resource for Land Rover folks. But first up in the news, we are going to talk about the new Land Rover Defender is to launch in 2016. And this comes from Autocar, and they had a nice little article kind of summarizing some of the things we've talked about in the past few months. And there apparently is a design. It's been locked down. Autocar has some artist renderings of what it might look like, and it looks to me kind of a combination between the DC-100 and a 110, current 110, as a kind of a, at least that's how I kind of envision it. Looks a little beefier to me than if, I guess it may not even be true, of course, but it looks interesting.
Yeah, their speculation as to what they think it will be. Again, that's just speculation.
Right. And of course, the whole entire article speculation. They say that that the chassis might be one of these aluminum monocoque chassis. There would be a four-cylinder diesel engine with some V6 variants available. It would have transmission would be an automatic. There was no discussion of it being of there being a manual available. So I found that kind of interesting.
Does that make it the first Land Rover ever to not be available with a manual transmission?
No, because the Freelander did not have a manual
available. It did in the UK.
It did. That's right.
It did in the home market.
What about the Evoque? I don't think the Evoque has a manual available.
I don't know. Could be wrong about that.
Then that could be the first one.
The Evoque is automatic.
Okay.
Even in Europe, there's not a manual available.
Yes. Right. And some of that is because the capability of automatic transmissions has changed dramatically in terms of fuel mileage potential. So when you have 7, 8, 9 speed transmissions, you really have the opportunity to forego a manual for purposes of fuel economy, which was the largest reason that the manual transmission was retained by Land Rover.
The automatics are actually better in terms of drivetrain shock as well, and smoothness, ease of driving. They're actually better on off-road situations too than a manual. I've driven both, and I prefer the automatic actually.
Oh, especially when now that they've added terrain response, which controls throttling and can control and travel of the chassis and such things. So I think that certainly adds to it, because then it's kind of controlling the computer. There is kind of controlling a little more.
Yeah, they can work together.
And even when I did I have to refer to this yet again because it was a cool experience. But when I was on the Land Rover Experience, even the current model Defender, which even though it was a manual, it still had anti-stall technology built into it, which almost made it kind of a little more automatic. You had to purposely stall that thing because it doesn't want to stall on its own.
Well, even the TDI that you're familiar with, you have to work to make it stall.
That's true.
It's possible, but you do have to work at it a bit. The old mechanical diesel engines were, well, yeah, but that's an electronically controlled diesel, and those things love to stall, as you've discovered, especially when you have a computer that just wants to shut the engine off at the first sight of anything being wrong. But the good old-fashioned mechanically pumped diesel engines really are pretty hard to stall because they have essentially an idle governor in them that keeps them at idle speed.
So production of the new Defender is supposed to come out in 2016. My guess is sometime in 2015, we will probably get some notice of what it's going to be like, and it'll be a big reveal, probably just as big as the Disco Sport and all the past models. So because, you know, as we've learned, Land Rover is really good at marketing, so I'm sure...
It will be no surprise when it gets here.
That is correct. That is correct. Speaking of new models, the Discovery Sport, Land Rover UK put out a short little 1 minute, 16 second video called Packaging. And it's a kind of a breakaway version of the new Disco Sport. And it was kind of interesting, and it kind of goes well with, there was an article in the current issue of Rover's Magazine, which is the holiday edition, 2014. And it shows, how they've the rear shock towers and the mounts, how those are made. They're kind of clear. They've put them in such a way that they're compact and they're out of the way to make more load space in the rear of the vehicle. We'll have a link, of course, in the show notes to the video if you want to see it. It's really interesting to see. It's a minute, but it kind of shows some things in a nice way. It shows, you know, this large open space, the three rows of seating, and how they move and can lay down flat. A really nice little video.
You know, one of the features I think we have to remember of the Discovery Sport, it really is similar in a way to what Land Rover has discovered about the Evoque. Both vehicles were really intended to bring new people into Land Rover ownership, because Land Rover feels that it needs to broaden the range of folks who would call themselves Land Rover owners. So the Discovery Sport and the Range Rover Evoque are really aimed at a new purchaser. I had an interesting conversation when I went to the Mid-Atlantic rally back in October, stopping at Land Rover in Richmond. And the general manager there, a real huge Land Rover enthusiast, noted that's a new kind of customer, to the point where the dealerships have to think about how they will talk to that person and how they will work with that individual, because they present them with a different set of criteria for why they're purchasing a Land Rover. So we'll probably see some different approaches. We as an enthusiast community, some of them will probably be discomforting to watch or to hear, because it really won't be the language that we're looking for when we talk about a Land Rover product. But that being said, the earliest of the Sports are actually being launched in January at a special event in Iceland. Land Rover has invited a number of journalists to Iceland to tackle them, and that would obviously mean off-road opportunities for them too, in a potentially hostile environment. And so I think they're still trying to drum home a Land Rover message, but it's going to be in language that the enthusiast community probably hasn't heard from Land Rover since the Evoque.
Do you get to go to Iceland? Are you going?
I do not get to go to Iceland, but I actually have a correspondent who will be writing a feature for Rover's Magazine, so it'll be in our spring issue.
Nice.
Very excited about that, yeah.
Just one observation here. I think if Land Rover is going to market themselves to new people, which does need to happen, otherwise if you rely entirely on your existing customer base, they're going to get old at some point, and that's not good. But
they don't need to buy new either.
Well, that's true. The hardcore guys don't buy new ones every time. But if you're going to market yourselves to new customers, I think if you've got a model called Discovery, that's the one you'd want to use for that.
It's true. It's a good point. It's a good name.
It is interesting they're bringing back the Discovery name, guys. This is a step that Land Rover in the U.S. moved away from with this series of alphanumeric names for models, the LR2, LR3, LR4. But they're bringing back the Discovery name. And as an enthusiast, I'm thrilled. You know, this model that started in 1989 really helped save Land Rover financially, because it was a huge sales success. So the Discovery should rightly plays an important role in Land Rover's very existence today.
Absolutely. I think it's a great name. I never liked the
Well, for some of us, the Discovery name never really left. It's always been there. And, you know, on the one hand, I think it's a good thing to quote, bring the name back. On the other hand, I kind of wonder if maybe some of that also is just trying to simplify by only having one name for the platform instead of having multiple names in multiple markets.
Well, the only reason I think they changed it was a belief that they needed to, when they broke away – when they broke away from the Discovery Tool molds, that the vehicle would look very different and have only a handful of styling cues, they thought it important to bring on a new name. They felt that the Discovery name was a tough one to get traction with amongst the potential new buyers. But this is, to me, is a nice example of a marketing effort in the U.S. that certainly sold a lot of vehicles, but really didn't gain any traction. Nobody really talks about the LR series in any way.
I think it's. I tend to agree with your thoughts on that. I had heard at one point that they had changed the name to like LR3, LR4 here simply because of the perceived reliability concerns that they had in North America and wanted to kind of get away from that association.
I've heard that, but I've only heard that from people who didn't like the Discovery 2 anyway.
Fair. So back to the Discovery Sport announcement. What did you said they're going to debut it officially in Iceland early next year, but just recently in L.A. there was a reveal there. Anybody know what that was about? Is that different than – I thought that was a North America reveal. That's the way I took it, and I pay attention to these things.
It's not an official reveal, but they wanted to take advantage of the Los Angeles Auto Show.
Sort of a sneak peek then.
Right, exactly. And they so the thought is to get a few of these new ones out to the Land Rover Experience places in the U.S., so that it will help introduce the vehicle to the U.S. market, and it will help cement that it's part of the Land Rover lineup. A lot of the folks who take the Experience program own either current LR4s or Range Rovers. So many Land Rover owners are multiple vehicle owners. And the Discovery Sport is perfectly placed.
Can't have just one.
Can't have just one. Right?
It is a disease.
They're like potato chips.
The Discovery Sport is perfectly placed to eventually, I suggest, replace the LR2 in the model lineup in the U.S.
I did read that in your article that I found interesting. The LR2 is going to remain in the lineup through 2015. Is that correct?
Yes, it is. Largely, I think, because of inventory issues, not just here but worldwide. Remember, the LR2 or the Freelander 3 there has really done pretty well in the rest of the world. So there isn't a demand for it to be pushed aside. I do want to express, you'll see it in the next issue of the magazine, I had a 500-mile trip in a 2013 LR2 when I went to the Mid-Atlantic Rally. A fabulous automobile. Fabulous automobile. Lowest warranty claims of any Land Rover product over the past 20 years.
I did not know that.
Interesting. Yep. In comparison to the Freelander it was based on.
Yeah, the Freelander won, however.
Exactly. And it, I also, even though I had to treat it gently because it was a loaner from a dealership for the weekend, it's a fabulous little off-road vehicle. And I'm going to suggest to all of you who are Discovery 2 owners and thinking that someday you might replace your Discovery 2, to look at an LR2 as your replacement.
There you go, Mark. See, Mark just bought himself a second Disco 2. You should have bought a Freelander 2.
I think I'm going to be set for a little while here.
I hope you are. Don't hit any standing Ford Escapes, please.
This one has a bumper. I should be okay.
All right, good. along the lines of the Disco, and speaking of the name that's been out there, Land Rover also put out, in conjunction with Tavistock Productions, they put out a 25 years of discovery video. It's 4 minutes, 12 seconds. Again, we'll have a link on our show notes, but it was cool. It was really enjoyable to watch. I thought they did a nice job of it. My favorite part was seeing discos go down and slide sideways in sand. I thought that was so cool. Has anybody else seen the video?
Yes, it's a terrific, uplifting, great music, people having fun with their discoveries. I mean, there's nothing speaks stronger to what Land Rover is about than, at least since 1989, than that particular video. They did a brilliant job with it. Even have a couple of shots from U.S. events. One of our readers is actually, magazine readers is actually in it briefly, you know, with a 2 seconds of fame there. And it's great fun to see. I recommend it highly as a something when you when your boss wants to think you're working, put the headphones on and listen. It's great.
it is really well done. It was it's only 4 minutes. They took videos from actual customers and used those. It kind of centers around it looks like the snowstorm last year that they had in the UK for several weeks, and there's a woman getting to work, and it was pretty neat. It was just neat little things they showed. And there's even some really grainy video that they used from somebody's cell phone. It looks pretty crappy, but hey, it fits. It was their father was out and had gotten stuck. So if you want a good positive video to share with your friends about why you enjoy Land Rovers and why you enjoy this activity, I think this would be the one to show them.
Did it give you any inspiration for your video projects?
No. Sorry.
Got me motivated.
Oh, it got me personally motivated, and I have, as a side note, I have begun the video production for our holiday party.
I was going to say, do you have any ideas yet for how you're doing that?
I do, actually. I'm going to come.
Good for you.
Not that anybody outside of the podcast would know this, but we typically have a winter event, and for our local Land Rover Club, we go out and off-road in the winter, and we do
the
one
winter
in the
classic,
and then the summer invitational. I'm putting them both together. So, and then, yeah.
Okay.
My problem these days.
An annual video then.
It's going to be like an annual video. And my problem these days is, and this is not on our show list of things to talk about, but since we're on the topic of video production, I love the GoPro, but here's why I don't like the GoPro. It has all the video now is of constant driving down the trail. You don't get anybody saying anything. You don't get any of that stop and watch people go through something. It's always from the point of view of the truck.
It's taken the human interaction out of
it. It has taken a lot of that out. And I, you know, my videos in the old days, I've been doing them since like, the first MARB that I went to back in 2005, right. I think it was.
Back when it was an 8mm camcorder on your shoulder.
Close. Yeah. And you would get interactions with people, and then you would see them also do some off-road stuff. So
Because you had to stop, get out of the vehicle, and aim the camera, and yeah.
Right, right. That's it. It has nothing to do with the, you know, with the...
Sounds like you need to just look for ways to revamp your techniques find a way to do that.
Right, right. Anyways.
Mind you, the truck-centric video is so much better now, thanks to that. We've gotten some really cool stuff with the underwater cams and the bumper cams and...
Again, I'm not against the GoPros. But there is a limitation that I've noticed that I don't think many people talk about. You don't get that human interaction part unless you make a point of doing it. And the hobby that we're into is, you know, truck specific, and a lot of folks will just take the GoPro, slap it on top of the windscreen, or they'll put it on the side and watch the tire move. That's nice for about 10 seconds. People don't want to watch that for 30 minutes.
It takes the art out of it,
I suppose. Yeah. Anyway, so that's 25 years of the discovery. If you want to make your own video, go right ahead, and we'll,
because it's so easy to do.
It is so easy, and we'll push it out to everybody, too. I'll be happy to do that through my accounts. Next in the news, Land Rover is going to develop, so they say, an all-electric Tesla Model X rival. And the Model X is supposed to be, I guess, kind of an all-electric four-wheel drive, off-roady. I don't think off-road's the right word, but more of a four-wheel drive version. And according to Autoblog, Land Rover is considering making an electric version of some Land Rover. It may be the Range Rover to compete, and prices, they think they would, it says Autoblog talking about auto car, is anticipating a price of around 90,000 pounds, which would be about $144,000 here, and which is matches the cost of a UK market Model S. And if they were to bring one here, it would probably have to be under $100,000 to match with the US market Teslas.
Does it come with an accessory generator so you can recharge when you've gone so far off into the woods that you can't get any power to recharge it?
Well, you know, that certainly is a consideration. I think there is discussion that it might not be a true all-electric one.
Okay.
It could be a hybrid version, which I think would be the
same. That makes more sense to me.
That would make a lot of sense.
But all-electric Land Rover is useless to me, I would think, because I would somehow drive it far enough away from power, and then I'd run the batteries out, and I'd be screwed.
Well, that's the big problem with all-electrics now is driving too far off the grid, if
you will. They're great in town, mm-hmm. but as soon as you step off the road.
But Tesla has built these supercharging centers across the United States, and their range, I think, is about 250, 260 miles. So they've tried to build these things to make it easy to
For most people in this country, most people just drive around town most of the time. It's not a bad thing.
No.
There are some advantages and disadvantages if you're a Land Rover thinking about this. I want to throw these out for your thoughts, guys. There's no question that an individual electric motor on each wheel offers the potential for the best traction that you could achieve. And electric motors, as you know, have torque instantly. So there's, again, the opportunity for very little slippage, superb traction. And automatically.
And the ability to control said traction and distribute it in the most ideal way.
Yes, absolutely, Harold. Yep. Now, the dilemma, as you've correctly identified, is one that we've been discussing right up to now. How do you generate electricity while you're off-road or while you're in a situation away from those highway-based supercharge electric outlets. The other one is the challenge of the enormous weight of the batteries required to push larger vehicles around. And the amount of space and weight they require, at least under current technology, is substantial. Therefore, I'm going to suggest that while there already is an electric motored Defender, a hybrid Defender that was shown at the Geneva Auto Show last year and was shown online running around, the likelihood that we'll see it on a heavier vehicle is pretty minimal. The most likely one would be one of Land Rover's newer aluminum chassis vehicles, simply because there's less to push and they're already built, if you will, with a cage possibility. You'd probably lose some seating. But the real question for Land Rover is whether this is worth it for anything other than help you meet EU and American CAFE standards. You know, for all of Tesla's hype, there still aren't many out there. The Nissan Leaf at the other price end has been a sales disappointment. The Chevy Volt has sort of fallen off the map. They're around. You can buy one, but you're sure not seeing them. It's not been a sales success for General Motors. Toyota recently has announced at the and it was at the Los Angeles Auto Show, that they're looking at hydrogen fuel technology, hydrogen cell technology instead, as an alternative to the challenges presented by current battery technology. So for Land Rover to put a lot of development money into this is questionable given the niches of marketplace that they occupy. Again, I suggest that the reasons they might have to do this have more to do with helping them meet the ever more rigorous pollution and so emissions and mileage factors. Those are going to be the key for Land Rover.
Well, I think where it makes sense is not as a pure electric vehicle, but as a hybrid. And I preach this a lot, but If you've got an onboard system with a compact, preferably diesel, because, well, number one, we like that, but number two, they're more efficient, small diesel-powered charging station to keep the batteries up, you really don't need a big stack of batteries. No, you can't run exclusively electric for a long distance, but the idea is the electric is there as an accumulator of energy, so to speak, and it provides the extra surge for the acceleration, but the onboard power plant, which is very tiny and doesn't put out a lot of power, but it's enough to maintain the batteries on cruising speeds. That makes a lot of sense, and that can be done efficiently and without nearly as much weight or bulk.
So the point that I was raising before or earlier is one of the challenge of weather extremes on the battery storage systems, no matter how small they might be. The last year, Tesla had a sort of pissing match with the New York Times when they loaned one of their auto journalists a Tesla for a trip from, I believe, Washington to D.C. to Connecticut.
Correct.
And he did it in the winter. And he found that his onboard gauges were giving him disarmingly challenging signals, that he was using far more power or electricity than he thought he should have, and therefore his range was reduced quite a bit. The systems on a Tesla automatically start shutting down those that are not vital to the actual forward or reverse motion of the vehicle. And so when he reached the plug-in station and plugged in, the plugs are unique, and of course there's a lot of power coursing in. He found that the Tesla would not release the plug. And this whole set of incidents, which Elon Musk reacted to, I can only use the term verbally violently, and went right after the New York Times for their incompetence, really showed that when you're talking about asking someone to spend, and as you correctly said, John, in the ballpark for $100,000 for a potentially luxurious electric car, I'm not certain that that's a group of people who want to wonder why the plug wouldn't release.
Or that want to know about the technology enough to try and figure it out.
When you're in this price range of a product, this is a group of purchasers who have much less tolerance for finicky, the finicky nature of new technology. There are early adopters who will jump into it, and they may be cushioned financially so it doesn't bother them. But the numbers that Land Rover would need in order to justify moving into this direction really require it to have, I think, a different layer of product. I'd be more tempted to think that they might move it away from the Range Rover and into the smaller Land Rover models.
Well, it remains to be seen, and certainly
it does.
It's an interesting discussion because you know, it's coming. I think you're going to see more and more electric vehicles at some point.
It's inevitable.
It's inevitable. You know.
There is now one on this island.
I see two Teslas every day and several Volts and a couple of Nissan Leafs, but that's only because where I work, they have a charging station on campus. So it's kind of interesting. But
well,
I,
and you work on a campus too, and there's always new, especially a campus. Your particular campus is devoted to technology and yes. The new frontier, so it's no surprise.
Yeah, but it's still cool to see two Teslas, in the parking lot there. That's pretty cool. Next up in the news, I believe this is a free book that you can read and download from Land Rover and other places. It's called The Vanishing Game. William Boyd has written a Land Rover-sponsored book, and the article indicated that he was just asked to make a book, and they wanted to have Land Rover in it somewhere. And he didn't feel pressure to have, to make it a Land Rover book, but just so apparently the story is about a gentleman taking something and transporting it from London, I think up into Scotland. From London. It delivered a flask filled with clear liquid from London to Scotland. His transport is a certain four-wheel drive vehicle. So if you want to read about apparently a good book, I don't know if it's good or not, I didn't read it yet, but you want to read a book that features a Land Rover, feel free to do so. It's called The Vanishing Game.
Is it available on tape?
I don't believe so. No, I believe it's just a digital download right now. The intent, I've started to read it. You can load it onto your tablet. You can load it onto your phone. It is text. It is visual. Of course, William Boyd is the author whom the Ian Fleming estate chose to carry forward on the successor James Bond novels. So there's a good connection there. And I think it's a very clever gimmick on Land Rover's part, largely to give you something to do while you're commuting. And it's it has nice elements of Skyfall in it.
Oh, okay. Interesting. I saw that he was the new writer of the James Bond series. I forgot that part.
Let's perhaps qualify that, but it's something to do while commuting on public transport, not necessarily something to read while driving.
Oh, I've seen people.
Not unless you get one of Google's self-driving cars.
That's right. Yeah, a self-driving all-electric car. We will have a link to the book. It is, though, www.thevanishinggame.com if you want to check it out, but we'll have a link on our show notes. So to close out the news, our arch rival, Chrysler Jeep, they are going to, so they say, take on the Range Rover with a flagship SUV. They're bringing back the Grand Wagoneer name and allegedly, they're going to move up scale, move up market, and create a Range Rover competitive vehicle.
So what you're saying then is the Jeep has finally admitted that they need to chase Land Rover.
I think that would be Land Rover humor, but sure, why not? They talked to let me pause.
Amazing here. How it comes full circle, doesn't it?
It is.
So they talked to Autocar, talked to the Jeep global brand director, Michael Manley, and they said that they are looking to move up beyond the Grand Cherokee, I think, which is more of a disco-ish competitor, if I understand their range correctly. And then they want to bring back the Wagoneer, the Grand Wagoneer, and then make it move it up. So they apparently announced this in 2012, but they're finally moving into that space or thinking about it. They are not competing with their sister vehicle, a Fiat, Maserati, which is coming out with a Levante. Apparently, it's going to be similar vehicle, but it's going to compete in different spaces.
Yeah, I think a Maserati SUV is a mistake, but
well, it wasn't for Porsche.
I don't agree with that entirely either, mind you. But I think Porsche pulled off something that most sports car makers can't.
Oh, you almost have to. I mean, Mercedes did it. BMW's done it. Porsche.
Not well.
They're selling vehicles and they're still out there.
Because there are enough dumb people out there that'll buy stuff that looks like an SUV, even though it isn't.
I look forward to your tweets and letters, and I'll send them over to Harold.
Okay, that's fine. Bring it on. But if you get water above the black part of the tire, you have voided the warranty on a BMW SUV.
So what happens when your favorite brand Jaguar comes out with a SUV?
I have a 45 at home with bullets in it.
As long as you pay for it, the vehicle that is.
I was referring to something else, but that's all right.
I understand. So Jeep
the
is
challenge. If I could, the challenge. Mark. I don't know if it was you or Harold. You who noted Porsche's success. The percentage of Porsches now sold. Rest with the Pan America sedan, and its larger and the Cayenne and the smaller Macan SUV. That's the largest percentage of Porsches that get sold worldwide. What it does is allow the company to have development dollars while remaining relatively independent. Land Rover faces.
Yeah, it's hard to stay viable as a company producing only 911s.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And for the challenge for Jeep will be which platform they have to create the development costs on a new platform to get a vehicle to truly compete against the Range Rover is going to be very large. And what Fiat hopes to have happen is that the Jeep name will produce a halo effect for buyers in Europe who, for where they would like to send a lot more Jeeps. But they're going to have to develop something that is going to be far different than what the Grand Wagoneer is going to be in the U.S. market.
They need to produce a vehicle that Europeans would want to own regardless of the name.
Yes, and the Jeep name does. I mean, you have to grant it. It carries a cachet in Europe.
It does, but the vehicle itself needs to stand up. And if they just send over an American Jeep, I don't think it's going to sell all that well compared to...
I agree with you. I think that's very well put. Just think, too, Jeep has to develop a large enough diesel engine for the rest of the world. And it has to be one that is as quiet and comfortable as what Land Rover has produced with its diesel engines. Now, they have some great diesel technology between Fiat and Alfa Romeo, but they're not particularly large engines. And something as large as a Grand Wagoneer, and to compete in that wheelbase size, it's going to have to be a pretty substantial engine. At the moment, they don't have one.
Unfortunately, they used to when they were owned by Mercedes.
Yes, they had access to different engines then, and they don't have that now.
Right.
And I think what they're – I'm going to guess what they're looking at is the profit margin potential. If you can produce a base Wagoneer at a $60,000 range, then you can easily outfit it with another $20,000, $25,000 worth of options. I think that's the real appeal for the Grand Wagoneer. I don't think that they're chasing people who aspire to a Range Rover. I don't think they're going to pretend that they're going to necessarily match the Range Rover's refinement.
I think you'll end up seeing them be equivalent to a BMW X5, maybe the X6. I think that's in my view, I see the BMWs being a slightly cut below the Range Rover. Maybe that's what their real market should look like. That's my opinion, of course.
But it's a huge cost. It's interesting. I mean, Fiat has a lot of demands on development dollars right now, and perhaps what they're seeing is this is a chance to move upscale at a relatively low development cost. In other words, they will take a Grand Cherokee, put an opera roof and a vinyl top and whatever the equivalents for this decade are for aspiring luxury and call it that. But in the end, I don't think they're going to have the development money for a true luxury automobile. I think they've already got that in Maserati, and they are trying to build that brand.
Yes, they are. And
unless they do a shared platform.
Which is an interesting possibility. The question for Maserati is, do they want to share a platform with a Jeep name? That'll be interesting. Could be some interesting interscene fighting at Fiat Chrysler.
Well, the thing is, it's possible nowadays to share a platform without it looking like you shared a platform. It's, back in the 80s, it was kind of the kiss of death to do a shared platform because, everything looked the same. And the Cadillac X bodies, for instance, are a glaring example of that. But nowadays, you can share a platform and share technology underneath the skin without the vehicles appearing too similar.
Right, but remember, it didn't help Volvo at all, and actually help force the brand sale in some way. I'm not certain that you really can get away with hiding the shared technology. And for the question is, do you actually at Maserati, do you look to share anything? Maybe you don't have a choice.
Depends on what the parents tell you to do, I guess.
Very much. Very much.
So
I think it'd be an interesting challenge for them. What could happen is that Maserati develops, what are they calling it? The Levant. They develop a version that Jeep can sell.
Interesting. Yeah.
Badge engineering.
Rebadge.
Yes.
Yeah. So along those lines, the most expensive Range Rover ever sold is coming out, and Holland & Holland, the gun maker in the UK, is helping to develop a Range Rover that will add $200,000 to the price tag.
Does it come with the 2-year bottomless whiskey well?
Close. It has executive class reclining seats. It has portable gun cabinet in the boot. It has sustainable sourced French walnut wood. It has scroll engraved door handles, which are actually quite nice looking. And finally, it has engraved door sills. All of that gets you an extra $200,000 will get you the most expensive Range Rover ever built.
It's interesting. The previous issue came with free whiskey.
It did, didn't it?
It did. Right. It came with a whiskey cabinet or whatever spirits you prefer, and Holland & Holland would keep that restocked for you, limitless, for a period of 2 years.
Apparently, that's no longer the case.
Apparently, that got too expensive for them.
Yes. The sticker price is 180,000 pounds. That's $285,000 here in the U.S. Fuel economy is 14 miles per gallon city, 19 miles per gallon highway.
So they did nothing to upgrade that.
I suspect it got a little heavier. I think sustainable French wood is probably heavier than laminates and other things they were using before.
They were using real wood in the Range Rover. It's just different wood.
Right.
Norwegian wood. Isn't it good?
Sorry. I think Carpathian elm was used for quite a while.
So that's the news. We will come back after the M word and we'll talk a couple features.
With the changing seasons comes the reminder that man is constantly doing battle with nature. That means dealing with a dirty little 5-letter word, water. Yes, water. Sweet elixir of life. Without it, no living thing can survive. Not anywhere. It's a simple molecule, just a pair of hydrogen atoms flanking a single oxygen. A chemist would illustrate this with a diagram that looks just like Mickey Mouse's head. How could anything so friendly-looking be so evil? Water is the most relentlessly destructive substance on Earth. Given enough time, it can carve majestic canyons from the mightiest rock formations. Water also has a very special talent for finding even the smallest crack or tiny pinhole in a seemingly impenetrable surface and driving itself deeply within. Scientists call this capillary action and have shown how water can be transported over great distances, even uphill. It's how trees move water from deep in the ground all the way to the uppermost leaves. It's essential for all living things, yet utterly destructive for everything else. If water finds its way through the roof of your house, it's absorbed like a sponge into the materials inside, providing sustenance to wood-boring insects and fungi, like rot and mold, all of which eat away at the structural elements until they can no longer withstand the relentless force of gravity, and your home collapses into a heap of partially digested wood and plaster. Water also acts as a catalyst for the corrosion and oxidation processes that turn expensive machines into worthless piles of junk. Like the cybernetic Terminator in the movies, it can't be bargained with, it can't be reasoned with, it doesn't feel pity or remorse or fear, and it absolutely will not stop, ever, until your favorite car has been reduced to dust. This time of year, water is particularly evil. Like most liquids, water becomes more dense as it cools, meaning its volume decreases slightly as its temperature decreases. What's unusual, however, is that water reaches maximum density a few degrees above its freezing point, and then it expands about 9% as it organizes its molecules in neat crystalline forms as solid ice. This expansion is very forceful, like a hydraulic ram, and can split large rocks or crack expensive engine blocks. Through capillary action, water can sneak its way inside a tiny crack and then lie in wait, just like Greek soldiers in a wooden horse, waiting for the freezing temperatures to force the crack wide open so that even more water can enter and do its damage. Repeated cycles of freezing and melting water is why places like Pittsburgh are known as the City of Potholes. One fortunate thing is that water is addicted to gravity and will readily flow downhill if given the opportunity. This is why a sloped roof is such a good thing. Only a minimal barrier is needed because gravity takes the water away before it has a chance to find a way through the roof. Flat and very low-pitched roofs are a special challenge. Since they don't drain very well, the water has plenty of time to spend just sitting on the roof. Eventually, it finds a way to cause trouble. In fact, gravity is a co-conspirator, aiding and abetting the water in its quest to invade your home. To make matters worse, capillary action allows the water to travel quite a distance before the leak becomes apparent indoors, which can make it difficult to find the actual point of entry. If you own a building with a flat roof, be prepared to wage frequent battles with nature. The only way to hold your ground is with the best materials and frequent maintenance. Unless you keep your vehicles hermetically sealed in a climate-controlled indoor environment, you will eventually have to deal with rust and corrosion. If you use them as intended, they will rust. It's inevitable. However, there are things that can be done to postpone the rust for as long as possible. The first is to reduce or eliminate places for water to collect on or in the vehicle. But this is difficult, except at the design or engineering stages. Second, there are many types of protective coatings that can be applied. These are best applied at the factory, but many coatings can be applied in the field with proper preparation. Third, since all coatings will eventually fail, regular maintenance is of paramount importance. The most important maintenance item is a thorough cleaning. Dirt and mud hold moisture against metal surfaces like a poultice, maximizing the exposure to water. They also allow problems to grow undetected until it is too late. The best way to battle rust and corrosion is to keep everything as clean as possible, thoroughly inspect, and repair any damaged protective coatings. Ironically, the best way to get rid of this water-trapping mud is to use lots of water. This is best accomplished with the pressure washer if you have access to one. If not, a good alternative is to drop a few coins at the local self-serve car wash. You can also drive through an automatic car wash, but you'll need to spend the extra money to get the underside washed. The goal is to remove as much of the dirty and salty accumulations as possible. There will still be water left behind, but at least it'll be clean water. Hopefully, gravity will remove most of it before it can do additional damage. Like a Las Vegas casino, the odds are stacked in favor of nature. Whether you sit back and wave the white flag of surrender, or dig deeper and fortify your position, is your choice. Sooner or later, you will lose the war, but whether it happens sooner or it happens later, that's entirely up to you.
And welcome back to the Center Steer Podcast, episode number 20. It is now the month of November, and in the Northern Hemisphere, winter is setting in. Winter is coming. And actually, in some ways, it already arrived in Buffalo. I don't know if anybody saw the...
Buffalo had a whole winter just last week.
Just in like one day, I think. So, which brings up winter driving.
And we'll be having the spring floods next week.
Winter driving ideas and tips. So what should you put in the vehicle? What should you prepare for? How do you drive? How do you change your driving tips? And Land Rover's actually done some of this for you already. The Land Rover Experience has a video, and of course we'll have a link in the show notes, on Essential Guide to Off-Road Driving Snow. It's mainly oriented towards the newer vehicles that have the all-terrain response settings, but there's still some things that are generic for anyone, no matter what vehicle you're driving. Things to put in the vehicle, water, food, prepare, make sure you have enough fuel before you leave, and understand your vehicle capabilities and limits. But I'm looking for what other things does the panel think that you should prepare for or get ready for?
Extra warm clothing in case you get stuck and have to sit there. Or yes. If you have to get out and dig yourself out and you get all soaking wet and you don't want to have to spend the rest of your day in just a t-shirt, you need maybe some extra clothes.
As happened in Buffalo, because there were people stuck on the road for 24 hours. They couldn't move. And so, maybe as you said, an extra change of clothes, some food. I would also throw in, make sure you have the capability to charge your cell phone so you can keep in contact with the outside world or let authorities know where you are and when they can come to get you. Here in the United States, at least, the Amazon always has a nice, almost seems like daily anymore. They have these extra batteries you can buy so you can charge almost any device. They're extra batteries, and there's some really good deals on those. Jockery, I bought one myself a couple months ago, and I have it in my car, and it's just an extra – it'll charge my cell phone three times, they say, before it runs out. So, I throw in extra batteries for your phones.
Don't forget the battery in the car itself. A lot of times we forget that no matter how improved battery technology has become in newer automobiles, the electric demands of newer vehicles is huge.
And the battery lives, whatever the warranties claim, really get taxed in the winter time. Cold weather just diminishes a battery's amperage and hinders its charging. We're also running more lights. We run the heater more often, et cetera, particularly in the northern part of the United States. I think it's really important to consider, now that it's only November and we still have some at least variability of weather, whether your battery ought to be just swapped out. Nothing like a fresh battery to help out. If you haven't changed the oil in your vehicle and it's due, this is a time to consider a winter weight of oil appropriate for your vehicle. It is a much better time to do the sort of automatic transmission maintenance of flush and fresh fluids. Check what's in your differentials and swivel balls. It's a lot easier to do now than it is to do in February.
Actually, October and April are the months that these automotive professionals target as being car care month.
That's very clever. That makes a lot of sense, Harold.
Yeah. During the season transition and from one to the other.
Yeah. And they actually promote it. In fact, a lot of them do special marketing campaigns those times of year.
Which is, interestingly enough, that's when the 109's, one of its batteries died, was right before that in October, and I had to replace that battery.
Yeah, clever timing.
It knew.
I just went through all of our vehicles and did a recondition recharge on all the batteries, make sure they're all topped up. And before I do any winter driving, I always carry a jump pack with me and make sure that's charged up too.
And the one item that Jeff did not list that should be looked at, especially on a Land Rover, is the transfer case. That's one people forget to change the fluid in, and it should be changed. And don't listen to what Land Rover tells you. You should do it once a year, and it's a good idea to do it ahead of winter. Wheel spin is the kiss of death. Wheel spin is the kiss of death on the center diff in the transfer case, if you have a Discovery. So keeping fresh, good fluid in there is a good idea. It's cheap insurance.
Well put.
I think
stuck in the video that I really hadn't given much thought to was those airbag jacks. I always kind of figure I have the high lift and I have a control face for it. That's pretty good enough. But if you're doing some off-road trails and you're in, a foot of snow, those high lifts aren't going to be quite as useful as one of those airbags.
Or even if you're on the road and you're trying to get moving, I think those airbags seem to be a nice, easy way to rock your car, and you're not going to also do further damage. High lift jack goes flying because you're trying to rock and move and get over something. That high lift could hurt somebody.
Yeah, I think I'm going to have to look into picking one of those up here in the near future.
I'd also throw out, don't forget to check your tire pressure. That's a nice, simple one, easy for people to do, and a lot of gas stations have free air. You should check your air pressure on a frequent basis. Don't rely on the new automatic tire pressure indicators. They can be wrong or incorrect. And if you especially mine, like on a Jetta, I have to reset it every time I check the tire pressure. But check tire pressure. You want to make sure you have nice, even the air pressure is distributed evenly across all the tires, that you get even wear. And you also make sure that you're actually connecting with the road. Traction is good.
Keep in mind that your pressure will be lower in the tire in winter versus summer. The air cools down. It does shrink. So you will need to add some air for the winter and take some out for the summer.
Right. Correct. Yeah. And it will – air will just escape on its own too. Sometimes things happen. You get a little – got to be mindful of that.
Nature finds a way.
It does. It does.
I guess the last winter issue, I just think we should all remember, we can feel pretty invincible in our Land Rovers in the wintertime until we actually have to stop or slow down. The laws of physics that enable a four-wheel drive vehicle to succeed in going forward are not they do not help you slow down or stop. And just a major part of keeping in control is the ability at any time to have to slow down or stop. We can get carried away in four-wheel drive vehicles, particularly in Land Rovers, in
tromping down the road and forgetting that we will still spin as craftily as a front-wheel drive or rear-wheel drive car will in icy conditions.
We have the same number of wheels and the same amount of brakes as everybody else.
And that was and then, that was evidence yesterday.
Certainly more weight.
That's true. More weight, and to Jeff's point, usually drivers that are less thinking when it comes to the weight of the vehicle, where they're going, and
get a false sense of security going.
Mm-hmm. And that was evidence yesterday here in Pittsburgh, and that was Saturday the 22nd. There was a freak ice event. It rained freezing rain, which turned to ice for about 2 hours on the roads. And people went slipping and sliding, hitting each other. I don't think anybody was hurt, but at least no fatalities. I think some people were hurt, but it just happened and no one was prepared for it. And things can happen and you need to be prepared at all conditions and all times of year. You never know what something's going to occur. Actually, I happened to take the Jetta out and was going down my hill. And for the second time in 22 years, I slid down from near where I live. And thankfully, the pavement dried up and I was able to stop before going through the intersection where you're supposed to stop.
So yeah, there's not a whole lot on the other side of the intersection either.
There's a hill, actually. You go down over the hill.
And some trees.
When this happened to me back in 1995, I went down that hill in a 1996 Chevrolet Monte Carlo. Thankfully, I had anti-lock brakes because I was able to get through the intersection and I pulled off to the left, off to a little lay-by that's there. And then 2 seconds later, cars come in the opposite direction. It was really exciting. Thankfully, I didn't get to the intersection this time, but I was thinking about it. Things happen. You got to be prepared for it or be mindful that things could occur. And along the lines of winter driving, something that our fellow panelist Mark sent to me a couple this week and he found was Tire Grip. It's a spray to enhance tire traction on snow and ice. For a mere $25 a can, you can spray it on your vehicle and they say it'll last for about 50 miles and it provides extra traction to your vehicle and people are praising it. It gets 4 out of 5 stars on Amazon. Anybody have any experience with it?
I don't know what's in this stuff, but we used to use hairspray. Works quite well. The chemicals, the solvents in the hairspray dissolve the surface of the rubber a little bit, make it tackier. Used to use it all the time on drag strips. And for those in the know, the Adorn brand works the best.
From what I'd read about it, they were equating this to basically pine sap in a can.
Yeah, you know what else works really well is Coca-Cola syrup.
Undiluted?
Yeah,
really?
Just the syrup. Huh. They used to have indoor go-kart races and stuff in arenas, and they would spray down the concrete floor with Coca-Cola syrup before they started.
Interesting.
Oh, yeah, it's like driving on one of those little insect glue traps.
Yeah, yeah, okay, that makes sense. So it's got to reduce – then I suspect it's got to reduce your mileage per gallon then, right?
Well, anything that enhances traction usually does.
It does, yeah. So
it increases rolling resistance, so yeah, it would.
So this would be something you should spray on before you're going to get into a problem, which
right,
ideally.
But you don't want to use all the time because, it decreases your mileage both in terms of fuel mileage and in terms of tire life.
Because it would probably interact with the tire.
It's going to.
That makes sense.
Especially if you're using something that dissolves the tire, like the hairspray. Yeah, it severely shortens the life. But it's sticky for quite a while.
Yeah, this product claims to improve traction on tire treads up to 300% on slippery surfaces. Black ice. I'm sorry. I have to take a pause. There's no such thing as black ice. It's just ice. Sleet and snowy roads.
There actually is a black ice.
No, there isn't.
Yes, there is.
No, it's ice is clear. Ice is translucent.
But if it's thin enough to where it is not very reflective and can't be seen easily, that is what black ice is, as opposed to a thick layer, which is called glare ice, because it's very, very shiny.
Then stop calling it black ice all the time.
Well, when it is black ice, it's black ice, as opposed to glare ice.
No, I disagree with all that.
The terminology gets misused a lot, I must say, but there is such a thing.
So we challenge any of our listeners to go out and purchase some Tire Grip and let us know how it works.
Is anybody amongst our group just a little questioning of exactly how this would function on a snow environment?
I'd like to know what the chemistry involved is, definitely.
I mean,
I can't see it helping a whole lot.
I can't see it holding anything. I can't see the snow holding.
Now, that depends on the snow. If it's loose, powdery snow, yeah, not at all. But if it's packed down and kind of slushy, yeah, maybe perhaps it might.
I'd almost say it had to be frozen. I can't imagine that even packed snow or even very wet snow would
still... That hard-packed stuff that we get stuck in a lot, that might help. You never know.
It might. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, one free spin of your wheel on that wet snow, and, well, now it's ice. So in that case, maybe it would assist.
Yeah.
Kind of like using a clister on your cross-country skis.
Yeah. I tend to think chains might still be the way to go.
But, yeah, I would have to think chains are definitely better in snow or ice than this stuff. But
or a track conversion.
For $30, it might be worth giving it a shot sometime.
It might be fun to do a side-by-side. You know, get out some different canned goods and spray it on there and see what it does.
There you go. Yeah.
Well, I was thinking as soon as it starts snowing, I'll leave my summer tires on the BMW and drive it like an idiot up my driveway. Then I'll try it with this stuff and see if there's a difference.
Will you still drive it like an idiot?
Yeah.
Well, there's no escaping that.
To get the car up the driveway when it's snow covered, but it you have to not drive like an idiot. If you attack it like I think most people unfortunately do, it will not make it up the driveway. So
no driving like Clarkson.
So that is winter driving. One other question about winter driving, and this is a debate I have with people outside of the Land Rover community. Do you warm your vehicle or not? I'm of the opinion you do not warm the vehicle. I think because the engine heats up faster if you're driving it and you get better gas mileage, and you also do better for the engine because you're actually using it versus just letting it sit there and you know, taking off time.
You actually can do some damage to the engine if you let it idle too long when it's cold too. So my advice is to let it idle and warm up just enough to where it can run steadily and reliable, and you've got fluids circulating in all the hydraulic systems. From that point, then you should just get underway. It's gonna warm itself up under load much more efficiently than it will sitting idling in your driveway.
Right. I think unless it's super cold, whatever that means to you, to me that would be the time you maybe would let it warm up longer than before setting off.
We're talking 5-10 seconds max anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
Just enough to get things steady, because a lot of times when you first start them up, they stumble a little bit, don't want to idle evenly, especially in a diesel. So get it idling, and by then you've got transmission fluid circulating through your transmission, through your steering, that sort of thing. So it's not frozen up, if you will. And then you should get moving.
I think it very much depends on...
I was going to say, on my discoveries, I generally did not let them warm up long. Kind of what you were saying, 5-10 seconds and then go. On my other vehicles, I generally would let them warm up until I saw some temperature come up on the water. They weren't happy to just start and then try and go, whereas Discoveries, everybody says not to let them idle and to basically start and go. So I think it's somewhat vehicle dependent.
Like I said,
a series truck, I would probably let warm up for a while.
It just depends. It's as soon as it can sustain itself and stay running. Yeah, I mean the series truck's kind of a pig when it's cold, but once you get it to where it'll stay running at idle, then you should go.
Yep.
Yes, you've all covered the points that I was trying to interject. It's very vehicle dependent. Once you're on fuel injected engines, you may think that you're helping it warm up, but actually the engine has already made the adjustment for the cold weather condition it's operating under. The points really have to do more with the ancillaries, like a power steering pump or the brakes themselves. Those are a little less temperature dependent, and there are fewer controls. The newer the vehicle, the more likely we have electronic power steering and so on. Those features really don't care what the temperature is. So when I go back with my series vehicle, it has to run on its choke for a couple moments, because it will stumble, and I have to go slowly as I started out, even if I'm running with the choke, because in cold weather, say 10 degrees Fahrenheit or less, I'm always running into the
hypoid or gear oil being quite thick, and it just takes a little longer for it to loosen up as you slowly progress down the road. I have no real choice. You have to go slow to start it off on a serious vehicle.
There's no way to not go slow in a serious vehicle anyway. Slower than usual, perhaps.
There you are, slower than usual. Yes.
Well, I think you should get moving as quick as possible in order to get some heat in the damn thing, because it's usually mighty chilly.
Right. They won't build heat at idle, especially in a diesel. And in fact, a lot of the problem with diesels especially is when you're sitting there idling and they're cold, you've actually got fuel condensing on the cylinder walls and not burning, and it actually will run down past the rings into the oil. So you want to build some heat by putting it under load.
Nice. Yeah, it takes the Jetta, even if it's just a TDI, at least 20 minutes to properly warm up, even, and that's driving it. I mean, it takes that long to, so this is why I think heated seats is the best thing, best accessory for being in a cold climate and having a diesel engine.
I would agree.
That's the final word.
I think that's why you saw the Defenders right from rest of the world Defenders right from the 90s forward being offered with heated windshields. It's because the defroster units really wouldn't kick out any heat to defrost.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah.
Series trucks are no better. They're probably worse.
And that's why the Jetta puts an electric resistance element in the heater box. So when they start up cold, they can produce some heat other than with the engine.
I think that only happens if I put the heat to full heat, because I've noticed if I have it like at half heat, it takes longer to warm up. So if you put the heat temperature control to max, it seems to activate that electric sensor.
I'd have to look at that. I'm not sure how it's programmed. Oh,
yeah. That's a guess. That's from what I just, right. Anecdotal evidence, but yeah. Well, that's winter driving, and we will move on from winter driving. If you have tips or ideas, go ahead and email them to us. Maybe I'll send you a sticker if you have a good one.
I have one tip.
All right, good.
In addition to what we've already discussed, and that is if you need to learn winter driving and you have a Land Rover, you should go seek out a local Land Rover club and get involved and go to one of their winter activities, because you get a chance to play, you get to learn from people who know how to do it, what they're doing, and you get to learn the capabilities of your vehicle in an environment where you're not likely to run into someone else and cause an accident.
And get proper tires.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes.
I think tires is always the number one item that anybody could get for in almost any situation. Make sure you have good tires. That's usually...
That's true in any situation.
Absolutely, yeah. But beyond that, yes, I would like to second Harold's point about you need to go out and test your vehicle's limits and see what it can do. And usually a club is good for that.
It's a good resource, good source of information locally as to what's out there and available.
Right.
And it's good.
All the learning, it's fun.
And someday you may need spare parts and somebody's going to have something that you might need.
Which brings up, because if you get plugged into a local club and you get to know people, there's a chance that if you do get stuck or you have a problem, you might need to call upon them, and you're someone you can call upon more than AAA. Because if you call on AAA, that's usually that's the end of your day. But if you call on a friend who's a Land Rover friend and say, "Hey, I got stuck, I need some help," they might come out and help you out, and you might have a beer afterwards.
Somebody might actually show up and say, "Swap out a fuel pump," while being shot at.
You guys were shot at?
There was a gun range right next to it, and they were continually firing their deer rifles, setting in their sights, and it just felt like I was being shot at the entire time. Yes. Jump every time they let one off.
Christmas is right around the corner, which brings up ideas for your Land Rover friends or for yourself on what you might like for the holidays. And a great resource for that is Rovers North Magazine. And for the record, I'm not paid or endorsed in any way by Rovers North Magazine.
Unlike some of us on this panel.
Unlike some on the panel, nor is the podcast supported or endorsed by the magazine. So this is a completely unsolicited. Their magazine just came out for the holiday edition. It's a five times a year publication, and this is the holiday edition. And I suspect that most people that listen to the podcast, the three or four people I think we might have, I hope there's more.
Hi, Derek.
Hi, Derek. Yeah, he likes a shout out. Probably already get the magazine, but if you don't, I highly recommend. It's free and available from Rovers Dort, from Rovers North.
I thought Derek had been in the magazine.
Might have been.
Didn't his truck get in the magazine a few years back?
I think it did. But they there's holiday gifts items in here, and the one that if anybody wants to get me something, I see offhand this is new. Haven't seen this before. The series one.
Get him a mug. He needs a mug.
I have six mugs.
There's no room in your kitchen left.
I have six
stacked up coveted mugs.
But I would like a Series 109 Expedition beverage opener. It is it's a Series 3 beverage opener because you know I don't have enough bottle openers.
You have a bottle top remover built into your series truck.
So, guys, I want to tell you the backstory on the bottle opener.
Oh, good.
Ooh, a good backstory. I like a good backstory.
It's a great backstory. There are pockets of Land Rover enthusiasts tucked away all over the world. Here in Maine, in southern Maine, west of our largest city, which is Portland, is quite a covey of Land Rover enthusiasts, one of whom is named Lars Schulander. Lars and his two kids, wife and two kids, live in the town of Buxton, Maine. Lars's family have been machinists, and they operate a family business of a rather impressive machine shop. And Lars, indeed, has used his machine shop to actually construct some of the steel panels on the floors of his 109, his floorboards, some other small items. He's very skilled, and he's an avid enthusiast. Lars is the one who one day at work, playing around with some laser cutting machine, cut out the outline of a Series 3 109 and noted that if he simply put an opening, it would serve perfectly as a church key or bottle opener. And Lars gave one of them as Christmas gifts to a handful of people. I happily was the recipient of one, to my great astonishment. It hangs in my kitchen right now. And when some folks from Rovers North came down to Maine when we did the LR2 road test a couple of years back, we went to Lars's company to both meet him and to see his facility. And that's when Rovers North decided to commission a run of those to offer as Christmas gifts. So it's been in the holiday issue for this year. I believe it was in last year as well. They're a delightful item. Heavyweight. They will not get through airport security, but they will travel beautifully in your off-road kit when you go to events or to camping. They're great fun.
Well, I'm going to order one. Because I think I need more bottle openers. So
I think I might need one as well.
Well, maybe we should go together, Mark. So I guess it leads to what would be number one on your holiday list, Harold. You've got to have something number one on your holiday. You have anything? Should we come back to you?
I guess.
Well, what do you what would you get as a get as a gift for a Land Rover enthusiast? Is there something that maybe you're more in the mechanical side of things? Is there something specific that is a good general all-around tool for someone to have or be available for the average Land Rover person? Not something too specific.
I have to think about that one.
Okay.
An O2 remover.
That's called a big hammer.
Specifically, what are you referring to, Mark?
They have those little O2 sensor remover sockets. They're pretty handy.
Yeah.
What do they do?
Well, it allows you to remove the oxygen sensor, which is sometimes very tricky to do because there's a wire coming out the top. You can't just use a regular socket.
So it's a dedicated tool for
that. It's a dedicated tool for removing oxygen sensors. It's technically 22 millimeters, and you can use a 22 millimeter open, but there's no room to swing it.
Okay.
So the little sockets do come in handy.
What do those run?
I don't know, $10-15.
No, that's not a bad gift idea.
If you're in the business of changing your oxygen sensors very often, which eventually, if you keep them long enough, you probably will.
Right.
It's not something you're going to use all the time, but you're going to use once in a while. And of course, once your buddies know you have one, you'll have more friends.
Harold has one.
I've got a couple, actually.
I suspect he doesn't loan them out, though.
I don't loan anything.
No, that's true. You don't.
I can't afford to. I don't have time to be chasing it down to figure out where it went. You want to come over and use it in my shop, that's fine, but I don't loan it out.
So in the back of the current edition of Rovers North, there's some off-roading type gifts that are general purpose made for nothing specific for a Land Rover, but high lift jacks, off-road equipment. There's the jack adapter for your high lift. So there's some interesting things here that you may be interested in. Take a look at the magazine. I guess I'm looking for ideas from folks that you might like, or you might like to get, or you like to give.
Basic recovery gear is always a good thing. I mean, you can never have enough shackles and straps and adapters and that sort of thing. Good pair of leather gloves, because those wear out. I mean, if you're looking for a cheap gift.
Right. I guess even that could go into play with our previous topic of, you know, winter driving. A lot of those things are actually applicable to giving as gifts. You could have some, you know, extra water and, as you said, shackles, gloves, extra blankets, granola bars. Those are always good for people if they're driving a lot, especially and you're worried they're not going to get stuck on the side of the road.
I want to just interject here. We've had the good pleasure of having Bill Burke as a columnist for the magazine for several years now. When I proposed to Bill that he create a wish list from Santa Claus based on his off-roading experiences, we didn't prompt him as to what to say and what to choose. So the items that Bill has chosen for his column in this issue of Rovers magazine, I think is quite telling, because it's really based on his considerable and multi-decade experience off-roading in all seasons, but particularly in winter climbs. But all of these that he offers, or he suggests to you, are really worthwhile. If you have a friend who is relatively new as a Land Rover enthusiast, I want to echo what was suggested earlier, and his or her first recovery strap and shackles would be a fabulous gift, because nothing is more fun to do with your Land Rover than to recover somebody on the side of the road. Nothing.
Amen.
You feel like $1 million, and everybody should have the thrill of doing so.
Absolutely. And I'm looking at I'm glad you brought it up, because I'm looking at Bill Burke's article at the moment. It's on page 32 of the holiday edition, and he has a list of 19 different items here that you could consider. And I will note that number 17, some heated seats. So great minds, and not that I'm putting my mind in the same as Bill Burke, but I have actually met Bill Burke. Nice guy. So heated seats, folding shovel, folding knife, limb saw, sturdy day pack, actual maps in case your electronics go out, some sunglasses, squeegee, and being a Series 3 owner, I understand completely, didn't have to read as to why.
It's your indoor defogging unit.
Your indoor defogger. Right. A spare filter kit, spare engine belt kit, assortment of tapes, as in electrical, duct, first aid, Teflon tapes. Folding shovel, I think I mentioned that one, but then possibly a winch accessory kit for your winch, a kinetic recovery rope or dynamic, extra fuel can, high lift jack, and his number one is a day or two of four-wheel drive driving and recovery training, which Bill actually does.
Yeah, available from Bill Burke.
From Bill, that's right, from Bill Burke for four-wheel drive, or I think that's what it's called. So, I think it's a nice, good start of a list of ideas for someone certainly to look at.
Of course, if you really want to go all out, a good gift would be a ticket to the Land Rover Experience.
As a gift, it's, as Bill Burke suggested in
his column in this latest issue, there's really nothing better than being able to share the capabilities of the vehicle with someone who's new to it. And the best way to do it is actually through skilled instruction, whether it's through the Land Rover Experience, a dealer event, a club event with some good marshalling that goes on. I love to be at events when novices attend because the look on their face, the jaw-dropping look on their face when they actually tackle something that to them was absolutely unassailable is priceless. It is a fabulous moment. And you know you have created an enthusiast from an owner when you help them accomplish that. I go back to when I was learning to ski. I tried it on my own because I thought I was way too skilled and too athletic to need instruction. And after several injuries, recognized an instructor wouldn't be a bad idea. It worked. It's the best way to learn to ski or snowboard. I think we should be doing the same with off-road instruction.
I would completely agree. And having done the Land Rover Experience, and I have some skill, but I'm not the greatest of skill, but I did learn something from myself, even going through the experience, already having some off-roading skill. So it is a great resource that I think people should make themselves available if they can afford it and get to one. I think in the United States, there are 3 Land Rover centers that have the experience. Is that correct?
I don't remember.
Guess I should do some research.
Yeah, I thought there were more, but it may be. The nearest one in New England is Manchester, Vermont. I believe there's one at the Biltmore in Asheville, North Carolina.
And is there one in Los Angeles?
There was one at the Greenbrier for a while. Is that still operating?
I don't think it is.
I think the Greenbrier closed.
That got relocated to the Biltmore.
I think so.
To the Biltmore, okay.
And is there one in the West Coast? Was there one in L.A.?
There is one in West Hollywood that just opened.
Okay.
And there is one
That's a whole different kind of experience.
There's one at the Quail Resort in California.
Okay.
That'd be all right.
Whatever it's called today, I think it has a new name.
But. Sure. Yeah, I know Land Rover, you get to their website, they have a list of all their experience centers. So, yeah. And just having gone to the UK and gone to those there, each one is different. So you might want to check and see what you're looking for as far as price and skill sets and things that you're looking to get out of it. Cause seem to be slightly different.
I think the fact that the one in Solihull includes a factory tour, that's got to be the best.
The factory tour was extra. You can do the factory tour without doing the experience.
Well, I understand that, but still it can be done at the same time.
It was there. Yeah.
And of course it should be.
It was kick ass.
That's not an option in my opinion.
No, it was. And I would further recommend that if you're going to do that and you're going to go to make the point of going to Solihull, take the factory tour. Definitely do it before the end of the Defender because there's a small chance you might get to see them build Defenders. Which is a dying art, and that's going to go away. So I feel very privileged that I got to see Defenders being built. That was kick ass. It was really cool. Like as far as I am from me to Harold right now, which is about 3 feet, I guess that's how close I was to the Defender line.
You didn't reach out and touch?
No, I made a point of not doing anything that would cause me to get thrown out.
I'd have a hard time not picking up a spanner and trying to put it together.
Yeah, I can understand. So, as we talk about the holidays and community, and the Land Rover does develop community for everybody, especially when you get into it. And if you go to an experience, you learn about that community, you join a local club, you get into the community and figure out how to use your vehicle, and you meet good people and good friends. And then sometimes it develops into a podcast even, has happened with me. But sometimes also things happen where you get called upon. You get a call at 8 o'clock at night because you took your mother-in-law and your wife and decided to take your Disco 2 out on the trail. And like, hey, I only met you guys yesterday, but I need some help. We had that happen in our club and got a call from a gentleman who did just that, and we mounted it.
His second time ever to go off-road, the first time being when he met you.
Yes, that's correct. And then like 2 days later, he's like, this is great. Let me show the family. So he did. He took his mother-in-law, and he took his
kids. Priceless. Watch this.
Was it? And he promptly got stuck and couldn't get out. So we mounted a rescue operation, and which took two or three vehicles. And he actually was in a place that was questionable as far as it took us a little extra effort. It wasn't just he got high centered. This was actually in a ravine.
Did a good job of getting it stuck.
He did, and I think we got one of our trucks stuck, and then had to rescue it, then to rescue him. So. Jeff, do you have any experience with that, with the getting calls? I think you might because of following your Facebook posts.
Well, yes. Not in a situation analogous to yours. But if you're – particularly when you're a series Land Rover owner, you have a near biblical obligation to your fellow Land Rover owners. A call came to me 3 days ago first from a fellow who owns a 109 here on the island. He moved here a couple of years back. He is a chef at one of our local restaurants. He doesn't have a lot of time to put into maintaining his ex-military 109, but he loves it dearly. It would not stack. Mm-hmm. Given where he lives right across the street from the restaurant, he doesn't need to have a vehicle that runs constantly. So he let it go for a couple of days. But then he called me to say, could I help him this very afternoon find out why his Land Rover would not start? I said, I have to do a podcast. Therefore, I'm going to come right down to your restaurant the very day that you're calling me. And I realized that I set aside work that I was supposed to do, work that would earn me valuably needed income that I was supposed to do, because a Land Rover owner had called and needed help. And I want to stress, this is a male Land Rover owner. So I wasn't rescuing a damsel in distress. He's married to a perfectly charming and lovely lady who loves the Land Rover also. But I was responding to his cry as a Land Rover owner. Blissfully, he had two of the simplest repairs imaginable for someone as relatively inept as myself. He said the battery didn't seem to want to turn the motor. When I tested the battery, it certainly had enough voltage at 12.2, 12.3 to do it. But the moment he cranked it a couple of times, it plummeted. That's when I checked the water level, the electrolyte level in the battery, and discovered it was almost empty. Filling it certainly allowed us to have a functional battery once it was jump-started. I also just happened to look at the points, and the points were totally closed up, which explained why it started a few days before, but not now. They had finally closed too much. Gapping it, didn't even have to clean them. Gapping it correctly, and it fired right up. And it stayed running. He let it run for a while, charged the battery. Battery had a healthy charge. I feel as though I have truly entered the nice list that Santa Claus puts together. I went to church this morning feeling even more entitled to have my prayers answered because I had done this. And I also realized that it is the kind of call that perhaps women who are mothers would understand. When your child calls for help, you drop everything to help your child. Fathers undoubtedly do the same. This, to me, is the familial experience and the near godlike experience of being helpful to a Land Rover, a fellow Land Rover owner. It cannot be equaled. I've never seen a situation in which a Land Rover owner has not stopped to help another.
Well said, sir. That is actually very true because we've had that in our own club where people
call. Well, it's karma. Yeah, what goes around comes around. So, you help now because chances are you'll need it in the future.
Yeah. Exactly. I said the very same thing. I have been in your shoes. And fortunately, I had somebody by phone to help walk me through. In this case, it's on the island. The other is, and I might just add this, I think we're all
just a little aware that on occasion, those who do not own Land Rovers question the reliability of Land Rover product. When the restaurant owner mentioned to me, right after the first phone call came, gee, Jeff, I hope you can help our chef. His Rover won't start. That means that somebody who is not a Land Rover lover recognized that there was a Rover broken down. You are obligated to uphold the reputation of the Green Oval, to improve it by getting it running very quickly.
Absolutely. I can't add to that, Jeff, because you said it very well. I mean, you do feel that pressure to keep the image up, to keep the reputation up. You know, I certainly have friends that always think that mine's broken down, or as soon as it has a problem, that's the first thing I hear about. Oh, it doesn't start. Oh, not again.
Well, they buy into the propaganda that they're, you know, the most unreliable thing on the planet. And of course, it depends on how you define reliable. But I mean, I think there's sort of an unspoken contract that you sort of commit to when you get into getting a Land Rover, that you sort of have this expectation.
Well, especially for the heritage vehicles, you know, you do have that need and that want to help out. I wonder, is that anybody experienced that in other brands? I mean, does that same thing happen for old Jaguars? Does it happen for, you know, Camaros, you know, Volvos? I don't, you know, do.
Well, I will say this. I believe it happens, but it's only within the mark, within the brand itself. I know that I have approached a Jaguar owner of an XKE in, at the time, what it would have been my Triumph Spitfire, when his would not run. And he took one look at me and another look at the Spitfire.
Down the end of his nose.
Right, exactly, from afar, and determined that nobody who would own a Triumph Spitfire could possibly know enough about his Lucas Electric system to help him out.
Hey, Lucas is Lucas, no matter what it's on.
I agree fully, but he did not. So I believe it is.
He clearly doesn't know what he's talking about.
Right. I believe it depends on brand. The interesting part is those who operate sort of series only or Defender only Land Rover shops constantly get requests from Discovery or early Range Rover owners to assist them with their vehicles as well, on the assumption that they will help because they're Land Rover owners. I think it's part of the fun of it all. It's imagine being able to do something good for somebody for a shared enthusiasm. I mean, I think it's fabulous, and I think it does happen between other brands. But I think that the receptiveness of people who own different brands is different.
Well, I think, but it comes down to sort of club following in that sense that, you know, I mean, within each brand, you're going to have a club that caters to people who are enthusiasts of that brand. And within that club, there's going to be that similar atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you certainly hope so. I wonder if, question I have, I wonder if is it extra special here in, say, North America because the community is typically smaller? Do you think that makes it a little more unique?
Well, I don't know. Look at Steve's experience in Norway. He ran into the enthusiasts who were doing stuff, and he was like the king of the show for the day.
That's true. Yes, because he was there and driving there and found an off-road crew. But I don't think they were specifically Land Rover people. They were just off-road guys.
No, it was a Land Rover club.
Okay. Oh, that's right. It was a club.
It was the Norwegian Land Rover club. All seven of them or whatever.
Well, maybe
I think there's a nice point said about you know, it takes a special set of attitudes to comfortably run a Land Rover in the U.S. Despite what Land Rover wants us to believe, there still aren't very many places to get them repaired, to get them keep them maintained. You still don't see a lot of them compared with comparable vehicles. I can travel quite a distance in the state of Maine without coming across a Land Rover.
To me, that's an attractive thing. I don't want to have what everybody else has.
I agree.
No, that certainly
it's very appealing, and it results in mad waves when you do see one.
Well, that's why I drive something that were only 180 of them ever made. So, you know.
Yes, yes. You get waves, except when they're from the newer Range Rovers, especially.
Waves or puzzled looks, depending.
They don't even notice. It just there should be a book of called Heritage in the owner's manual, so to let the new people know this is what this thing used to be. Look at this.
Well, they should actually. My comment earlier about the unspoken contract. I think for those people, they should have an actual written contract. You will understand where you came from, and
right. Do you know what you're buying? Well, and that goes back to the beginning of the podcast when we talk about the news and all the new things coming up. You know, that we're going to get away from that, I think, as more of the newer vehicles come out and change the brand and change things. And it's going to be incumbent upon us to keep that older community going. That's probably actually, now that I think of it, probably one of the reasons to keep the podcast going, so we can talk about old stuff, which we don't always do as much, I guess. But
yeah, but it's very clear we're all interested in preserving the heritage.
We are. We are, definitely, absolutely, and but we also realize that the newer things keep the name out there, keep things going a little bit. At least there's some awareness and understanding that's out there.
You know, guys, one of the things we have to acknowledge is that everybody enters the Land Rover community from different places. You know, I've been the editor now for 20 years of Rover's Magazine, and I am fully aware that for a block of our readership, the Discovery One was the first Land Rover that they ever knew. It's, you know, you're of a certain generation. That's your Land Rover.
Right.
The Discovery Two is your Land Rover for another group. Different iterations of the Range Rover are the entry one. For me, I'm old enough, so it was a series Land Rover. And the fascinating part to me is that the successful dealerships, the ones that are not just pushing automobiles, but actually are cauldrons of Land Rover enthusiasm at the same time, all have their walls festooned with heritage photos, with timelines. Land Rover North America puts these out for the dealers. They want their customers to know that even though that's not what they're buying, that's what preceded the model that they've chosen. And I think that they do about as good a job as anybody could ask in marketing the heritage, because we're not particularly a society that cares a whole lot about heritage. So you have to adapt to how Americans want to buy anything, and heritage plays a relatively small role in it.
Sadly,
plays a big role. Yes, I agree. Sadly,
yeah. But your points are well made and well taken. I think that's very much the case. They do, as good as they can. Especially for a mark. I mean, you look at the 25-year of Discovery video that came out. You think that do other marks and brands do that? I don't recall. I mean, that does happen. You know, I'm sure that for the Mustang and for the Camaro, there were probably things that the brand put out to praise that mark, or that vehicle. But I think Land Rover typically is good at that. That's that marketing thing we usually talk about. They're good at marketing, and I think they keep pulling some of that heritage back to keep folks understanding where the brand came from and what it can do.
Well, I think
John, you went to you said you went to Salihal.
Yes.
When I at the New York Auto Show these recent years, Land Rover's put a considerable effort to flying Land Rover executives over from the UK to talk and actually to see the American market for themselves, because it's so important. I have never met one who said, I really don't care. I have a great job, but I don't really care about Land Rover itself. They are extraordinary enthusiasts. Most of them on their phone have a photo of some heritage Land Rover that they own over in the UK, and they want to show it to you. They're like baby pictures.
It's really good to hear.
It is really good to hear, and it can be hard to believe because the new product lineup at times seems to be aimed at different markets than the heritage. But that being said, do you remember the president of Land Rover a couple of years back was a fellow named Andy Goss? And Andy, he was the president worldwide of Land Rover. He's now been moved up to a corporate position with Jaguar Land Rover. But Andy Goss, when I first met him and introduced myself at one of the auto shows, said, yes, he said, I have a Defender at home. That was reassuring to hear.
Yes, very much so.
And he said it with just a Midlands accent, as thick as mine is of a Boston accent. It was fabulous to hear it.
Not only was he happy, not only did he have a defender, but he was happy about it.
He was thrilled. He loves his defender. Well, so I'm encouraged by that all the time, and just remind myself that every generation will have its own Land Rover that it will embrace. And as long as the product has the spiritual qualities that we associate with Land Rover, it doesn't really matter which model. It'll become their heritage, and it's the model they embrace. The current vice president of Land Rover is a brand in the U.S. is named Kim McCullough. And Kim's first Land Rover, and thus her favorite, was her Discovery One. She has a Series One at the moment, an actual early 50s Series One. But that was her favorite one because that's the one that brought her into the Land Rover fold. So I'm very encouraged by that diversity of Land Rover models that appeal to people. It doesn't just have to be one. Well, I want to close first by just thanking you guys for letting me be a part of these podcasts. They're delightful to listen to. We'll post it when you're ready with it, edit it. We'll post it on the Rovers Magazine Facebook page so that more people will be aware of it.
So you listen to these?
Oh, yeah.
Really? Not just the ones you're in?
No, because I I'm hoping that the ones that I'm not in are really inferior, but that's not the case. I'm very disappointed to see how replaceable I am.
No, I don't think so,
but
sir.
Just to say that this is just another wonderful way for the Land Rover community here in around the world to stay connected. And I applaud the effort and energy that you put into this. And thank you for letting Rovers Magazine be a small part of this.
Thank you. And it's nice to hear that you you do appreciate it, because sometimes we sit here in our little basement studio and wonder, is anybody actually listening?
It's true.
Well, I will tell you the reverse. I sometimes sit on this island in front of a laptop editing a story saying, is anybody really going to read this? So, yeah.
Yeah, I understand. Well, Jeff, thank you very much for joining us this month on the Center Steer podcast. We really appreciate you joining us, and I'm glad the connection mostly remained well. I'll hopefully edit out some of the drops, but for technology going out to your island in Maine, I keep forgetting the island's name.
Vinyl Haven Island.
Vinyl Haven.
Yes, it's like apparently some floor coverings were seeking refuge.
Well, you know, you're not the first one to crack that joke.
I imagine I'm not. I'm not that original.
So I encourage everyone to go out to Rovers North. It's a great resource for Rover Parts. Great magazine that Jeff is the editor of. And I really like the picture on the backside of this, the holiday edition, with the looks like a Series 3 outlined in lights. So it looks nice, very festive.
You could do that to yours if you were so inclined.
I have done that to mine, actually, oddly enough.
Well, I want to let me just toss this in as a holiday greeting to everyone, or a Christmas and greeting to everyone. The photo is actually that of a photographer that we interviewed in this issue of the magazine. His name is Paul Lewinsky. He's been a longtime reader of the magazine, and I came across him through the website Petrolicious, which is very entertaining. I recommend that to all of your listeners. Paul photographs the finest vehicles in the world for Bonhams, Goodings, and those other major auction companies. His favorite vehicle is his Series 3. That is the one
nice
that captivated me on the Petrolicious interview. I immediately found him online, contacted him. He couldn't believe that he would be interviewed in the magazine because he loves reading about Land Rovers. He has been a subscriber to the magazine for a while. And he shared that very Christmas card with us so that we could share it in turn as the back cover and our Christmas card to our 25,000 readers around the country and around the world. We really appreciate what Paul Brandt brought as a professional. But I just think it speaks volumes to what Land Rover enthusiasts really bring to each other.
I think it's quite fitting that this picture shows the Series 3 festooned with Christmas bulbs, some of which appear a good bit dimmer than the others.
Very appropriate.
Oh, those would be those. That's that Lucas bulb, right?
Yeah, correct. Yeah, that's the Lucas bulbs. Yeah, Lucas Christmas bulbs. So that brings to a close the November edition of the Sinister Year podcast with our guest, Jeff Aronson, editor of Rovers North magazine, Harold sitting across from me, and myself, John Costage. We hope you join us next month when we should have planned to have the guest as the sales and export manager from a dealership in the UK named by name of Mark Griffiths. And if you have ideas for someone to join us as a panelist in future episodes, go ahead and send us an email. I'm going to turn off comments on the podcast, on the website, because all it is spam. I'm not getting anything that's anything good out of that comment section. So we're just going to go straight to direct emails. And
we have a Facebook page too, right?
We have a Facebook. Yes, thank you. We have a Facebook page. We have G+, though I don't think anybody's ever looked at that. We have a Twitter account, and we have a website, and you can go to the website, sinistereyear.com, and get access to all that social media and get in contact with us. And I also have been in touch with Land Rover Live, which is a video podcast, basically a video podcast, and talking to Matt about having him join us on the podcast too. So let's look for that in the future. So this is episode number 20 for November. Have yourself a wonderful holiday. We will talk to you probably towards the end of December is when I'll record our next podcast. Thanks very much, everybody.
The Center Steer theme song, Sunset Rider by the Tritons, is available from Nivio's Musicality. Check it out at music.nivio.com.
For some reason, Skype allowed me to have you on two calls at once, Jeff, so I hung up the one that was just you.
All right, that's fine. Good.
We were having twice the Jeff, I guess.
One is plenty, I'm told.
Depends on the price.